Hello, listener. Hello, reader. Hello, writer. Hello, audience. Hello, visitor. Hello, explorer, adventurer, performer. Hello, encounterer, codifier, curator. Hello, fellow participant. Hello, thinker, feeler, witness. Hello, watcher, observer, activator, facilitator. Hello, cherry picker, analyzer, reviewer. Hello, arbitrator. Hello, censor, editor, proofreader, typesetter. Hello, architect, builder, graphic designer. Hello to those who draw links between things. Hello, referencer, referee, reference point. Hello, speechmaker. Hello, sponsor. Hello, space. Hello, Hackney. Hello, London. Hello, internet. I'm here today to talk about fear and the sea and a piece of work that keeps changing. A couple of years ago, I was asked by a friend to write a short text called Lost at Sea. The title was my only guidance, and so I sat in my kitchen, which had blue walls and blue and white tiles, and imagined the room was actually filled with water. That as well as being in my kitchen, I was in the sea. This text has been through a few different manifestations since. I adapted it for a spoken word performance, incorporating a strange newspaper article that appeared in the paper at the time. Then I showed the work as a sound installation, playing a recorded reading of the text through a radio in a gallery space. Lastly, the work is slowly making its way into a short video made up of stills taken by photographers around the UK of water they find in their homes. A glass of water, condensation on a window, a dripping tap. Actually, that's not the last of it, because it's appearing here too. As I sit here in Space Studios, my voice is disappearing into the air, slightly amplified, working its way through the ether and finding you. But I'm not here to talk about air. I'm talking about that other elemental force, water. A few things happened around the same time. I wrote the Lost at Sea text that I'll play you shortly. I was reading a book called The Sea, the Sea by Iris Murdoch. And I was starting to swim again, breathlessly. Breathlessly because I'm afraid of water. I feel the fear rising when my lungs are emptying, when I'm exhaling bubbles to the surface. It comes on quickly and grips tight, forcing me to swim up to the surface and gulp the air greedily. At some point, I realized something was going on. The sea seemed to be a recurring theme in my life, and perhaps my fear of water was the cause of this. I'm going to share a few exhibits with you. Exhibit A.
You were sat at breakfast this morning, drinking a cup of coffee and reading the newspaper. As you turned a page, one article in particular jumped out at you. I'll read it to you. Dive Center Boss in NHS Swindle. A diving center boss swindled almost 250,000 from the NHS by claiming to have treated non-existent patients for cases of the bends, a court heard yesterday. David Welsh and two accomplices billed health trusts across Britain for supposed treatment in the centre's decompression chamber. Though genuine names, addresses, dates of birth and national insurance numbers were used, those people had never suffered the bends or been treated in the hyperbaric chamber, Plymouth Crown Court was told. Many of the bogus patients had taken diving courses at the centre, but eight of the patients told police they had never been diving, and one man who had supposedly been treated for bends said he could not swim. Perhaps that's why you're feeling so melodramatic today. Since you read this article, you've had the notion of pressure on your mind. You have carried it around as you performed your daily tasks, and all the while the power of this text has grown. You imagine the sea as a cube with six sides. Five of these sides are coated in a limitless blue, stretching far into the distance. One wall of blue is followed by another, and another, each one a little darker, until they fade to indiscernible night. You are at the center of this cube, and the walls of the room in which you stand form the first, palest wall. You become aware of sounds of water in this space and outside, of water sloshing in bottles, through pipes, in sinks, of flushing toilets and heaving tides. With every reach of the tide, you picture an invisible level of water rising in this room. Is it above your ankles yet, or tickling your cheek, slapping against your ears, wetting your hair? You realize in a moment of self-reflection that this is what fears are made of. A fear can start with a joke, a misplaced glance, printed text, or any other insubstantial thing. Perhaps that's why you're feeling so melodramatic today, because you know that fear, like water, tends to follow the path of least resistance.
This is Lost at Sea, which includes an excerpt from a newspaper article that appeared in The Guardian on Wednesday, 9th of July, 2008. Notice how the text opens by introducing this newspaper article, quoted with its recognisable language and tones, and then moves on to fiction. I'd like to bring in another idea at this point, the idea of authority, and in particular, the authority of broadcast media. For a while now, I've been working with newspapers, and often a newspaper article is a starting point for a new project. I like beginning with this supposed fact and putting it next to a new fictional text that I've written. We rely on broadcast media to bring us some semblance of truth, but though I am a consumer of newspapers, I believe it's a shaky ground to base your understanding of the world on. I think that's why I weave these truths in with fiction. Sometimes I absorb the source material, often from newspapers, and play it back out using broadcast media. So in the past, I've played Lost at Sea through a radio in a gallery, and I've had a text printed in a local newspaper and distributed to people's homes. I suppose I like this article from The Guardian because it's about a deception, the deception by the dive centre boss. A truth has already been questioned, an authority destroyed. Perhaps that naturally leads me to destroy the authority of the article by surrounding it with fiction. For a different showing of this work, I took the facts out of the newspaper article and gave them to a journalist to write up as a new text. Exhibit B. Cheating divers plumb depths in NHS scam. Three men tried to cheat the NHS out of £250,000 by charging for fake diving chambers treatment, Plymouth Crown Court heard yesterday. David Welsh and his two co-defendants used names of real patients at a diving centre to charge health trusts for specialist treatment in decompression chambers that never took place. Although many of those named had used the centre's swimming pool, eight said they had never been diving, and one claimed he could not swim. This was written by Gavriel Hollander in the style of a local newspaper. When I told him the original title, Dive Centre Boss in NHS Swindle, he laughed and told me that swindle is a classic piece of journalese. Exhibit C. I was reading about the Foley artist in the paper at the weekend. He works on nature programmes, and described how he'd make the sounds for some sea creatures by recording in a hot tub at a sound mixer's house. Here's my impression of a Foley artist doing an impression of a sea creature. Hopefully it sounds quite similar to a noise I played a bit earlier in this broadcast. One of them was live, one was pre-recorded. Exhibit D. Believe it or not, is a recording that plays from an alarm clock I got from Argos when I was about 13. It's called a dream traveller and wakes you up with the sound of birdsong. It sounds like a nice idea, but the recording was on such a short loop that it gets annoying really quickly. The recording I just played you of sea, surf and seagulls is meant to help you sleep. So the sea can be either a terrifying force or used to lull a 13-year-old to sleep. Exhibit E. Hopefully things are coming together for you at this point. I've talked about the sea as a thing of beauty, a thing of safety, and a thing to provoke terror. I've talked about truth and authority, broadcast media and fiction. I've talked about how I've adapted one piece of writing, Lost at Sea, to show it in different settings. I'll leave you with one last exhibit, a new text that hasn't found its way off the page before today. It may prove as slippery as Lost at Sea and transform into different things, or this may be its last outing. It's called Undercurrents. A curl of white unfolded, pricked with minute holes. It careered from side to side, doubled back on itself, drifting along as she walked with the cup in her hand, never interrupted, always rising, but without rush or hindrance. She found her favourite spot, not with purpose, but by feel. The space that at this moment held a flat oblong of light on the floor tiles, which bent up against a wall. She stood there, at that place with no specific function, her thigh resting against the table, her feet a little cold, the mug's hot rim touching her upper lip, a footstep's distance from the wall and bathed in strong sunshine. As she stood, she thought, and her eyes rested unknowingly on the blinking tip of Canary Wharf, which poked above a block of flats outside. She blew across the mug's top, so the rising vapour flattened, spiralled into a slow chaos, then righted itself. Though she would not know it, she stood in this imprecise spot many times, her eyes held by that other winking eye. She was struck by it one afternoon when the fog outside pressed its sleek back against the window. The flashing light filled the sky then, and for a moment she mistook it for lightning. But its pattern asserted itself, and she recognised its repeated message. Home. 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 Gently spoken. Another time she noticed it when for a few short seconds its silent appeal ran in synchrony with the sound of a dripping tap in the kitchen behind her. Canary Wharf is a landmark on her journey home. Only as she nears her flat does it show itself. This significance is interwoven with any other impression she may have brought with her of the famous building. And this time she noticed Canary Wharf again, as her mug was pressed against her upper lip and her feet grew cold. She stepped over to the window and admired this light, which, it now occurred to her, was a beacon, throwing its signal out for all to see. She leant closer, clinking her cup against the window pane, so that it exhaled a fine mist of condensation in reply. Something shifted. She watched as a wave, dark and frightful, crashed across the lawn outside. A tide was rising, sloshing in through open windows and tearing leaves off trees. She stepped back in horror, aware of the wet slap of her foot in a puddle behind her. A wall of water was already pushing its way along the corridor, and it was suddenly in the room, knocking over chairs and sweeping her legs from beneath her. She thrashed, but there was no time to fight, as she was carried and pressed against the ceiling, struggling to tilt her head and gain some time, still holding her mug in one hand, whose contents had been spilled and absorbed into that single overbearing force.